The country just was not ready for this kind of book. It was starting to happen, but that same publisher and that editor was who we finally went to in 1973 with The Front Runner.
In retrospect, I had no idea what I was expecting. Some welcome party? A sense of belonging isn't something that will happen overnight, lickety-split.
Border lies, the rate for distracting from Russian ties.
I'm guilty! I'm guilty!
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Taiwan's marriage equality proposal pleases no one. The Front Runner crosses the finish line, and queer youth remember the Rainbow Man. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 23rd, 2019. The government of Taiwan on February 21st became the first in Asia to submit a bill to its lawmakers proposing some form of civil marriage for same-gender couples. But most everyone agrees that the proposal falls far short of full equality. Members of the Legislative Yuan, Taiwan's lawmaking authority, are faced with the deadline of May 24th to comply with the island's high court ruling in 2017, ordering them to open civil marriage to same-gender couples within 2 years. The Constitutional Court said that marriage equality would automatically come into force if lawmakers failed to act by then. To complicate the situation, Taiwan voters in November specifically rejected full marriage equality, but approved less-than-marriage civil partnerships in separate ballot measures. However, while that outcome puts pressure on lawmakers to follow suit, voters cannot overturn high court decisions. The government apparently doesn't want to change the civil code to open marriage to same-gender couples, but to create a separate category for them that is ostensibly equal to marriage with or without the name. The major anti-equality group in Taiwan, the Coalition for the Happiness of Our Next Generation, sponsored all of the homophobic measures on last November's ballot, including a ban on LGBTQ people and issues in school curricula. A spokesperson called the government's draft bill to recognize same-gender couples unacceptable.
Taiwan Premier Su Tseng-Chung said that this might fall short of expectations, but after all, it's a start, and that I really hope our homosexual friends can wait a bit longer. Jennifer Liu of Marriage Equality Coalition Taiwan told Gay Star News that it is not fair to ask the LGBT community to wait a little longer. But she said that the battle over competing anti- and pro-queer ballot measures last November has sapped many activists' energies. Many LGBT people don't have the resources to face that battle again in their lifetime, she said. This bill may be the most possible way to give almost equal rights to same-sex spouses. The current draft legislation gives one of the same-gender spouses the right to adopt the other's biological children, but does not allow joint adoption. There are no specific provisions addressing queer unions between Taiwanese citizens and foreign nationals, nor same-gender couple access to assisted reproduction. But someone in a same-gender union can be prosecuted for adultery. It remains unclear what form the same-gender couples bill will take along the road to possible passage, and whether or not activists will go back to the Constitutional Court to challenge a less-than-fully equal marriage measure.
Gay and lesbian couples in 14 of Mexico's 31 states now have marriage equality. The Supreme Court of Justice of the nation this week unanimously overturned a marriage ban in Nuevo León and ordered lawmakers to create new provisions in the state's civil code to include same-gender couples. It's the third time the country's top court has struck down a state's refusal to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. Queer couples in Mexico's other 17 states can currently marry if they go to court and get an amparo, an expensive and time-consuming process that nevertheless cannot be denied by a judge. Lesbian and gay couples can already marry in the Federal District of Mexico City. Mexico's High Court ruled that all state marriage bans were unconstitutional in 2015, but it has no power to strike them down unilaterally. Each remaining state ban must be contested separately.
Kenya's Supreme Court has postponed a much-anticipated ruling on the decriminalization of gay sex that it was expected to announce on February 22nd. Justice Chacha Mwita announced instead that some of the judges were still mulling a voluminous number of files submitted for the case by several petitioners. He set a new announcement date of May 24th. Acts against the order of nature in Kenya are currently punishable by up to 14 years in prison under the penal code the East African country inherited from British colonizers.
The U.S. ambassador to Germany, Richard Grenell, the highest-profile openly gay person in the Trump administration, is leading a global effort to end the criminalization of same-gender sex. NBC News, which was first to report the initiative, said that LGBTQ activists from across Europe were being flown to Berlin this week for a strategy dinner at the U.S. Embassy on how best to push for decriminalization. Private consensual adult same-gender sex is a crime in 72 countries on the planet, mostly in the Middle East, Africa, and the Caribbean. Cynics note that the launch of the campaign was prompted by recent reports of the public executions of young gay men in Iran, a country that probably tops the president's boogeyman list. However, one of Trump's favorite Middle East countries, Saudi Arabia, is one of at least eight countries that also executes gay people. Grenell, in an editorial in the German newspaper Bild, pointed to India and a few other countries that have recently decriminalized same-gender sex among consenting adults. He said that reasonable people must continue to speak out about laws in other places, including Chechnya, the Russian region where authorities have been violently purging gay people since early 2017. Tony Perkins of the far-right Family Research Council questioned whether President Trump or anyone else in the administration authorized this campaign. But Grenell told NBC News that the initiative is widely supported by both parties. A tweet from queer media watchdog group GLAAD said that, "We'd believe that the Trump administration will work to protect LGBTQ people around the world if they had not attacked LGBTQ people in the U.S. over 90 times since taking office." For his part, the president seemed oblivious to the effort when a reporter asked him about it this week.
Your
push to decriminalize homosexuality, are you doing that and why?
Say it.
Your push to decriminalize homosexuality around the world.
I don't know which report you're talking about. We have many reports. Anybody else?
In other news, actor Jussie Smollett was arrested in Chicago late this week and charged with felony disorderly conduct for filing a false police report. Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman reports.
Smollett is said to have faked an attack that sparked widespread outrage last month. The actor, a star on Fox's hit TV show Empire, told police he was violently attacked on the street in an apparent hate crime. Smollett, who is African-American and gay, said the attacker shouted homophobic and racist slurs as well as, quote, "This is MAGA country," and placed a rope around his neck. Police say Smollett paid the two brothers, who were personal acquaintances of Smollett, to carry out a staged attack. The Chicago Police Department cite records from a hardware store where the brothers purchased the rope and surveillance video of them picking up other supplies. Earlier this week, local media reported the attack was planned after a racist letter addressed to Smollett and sent to the Empire studio did not receive much attention. The letter contained a white powder, which was later determined to be aspirin. The FBI is now reportedly investigating the letter. Jussie Smollett has rejected the recent reports and maintains he gave a truthful account of the attack. I'm Amy Goodman.
Though Smollett received initial support from several celebrities and politicians and from the cast of Empire, its producers announced late this week that he's been suspended and that his character is being written out of the last two episodes of the season. Some stories claim that he cooked up the scheme in an attempt to boost his salary, which had reportedly earned him from $65,000 to up to $125,000 per episode. Smollett has been released on bail of $100,000 and faces up to 3 years behind bars if he's found guilty of felony disorderly conduct for filing a false police report.
But finally, some happier news. The family of Serbia's lesbian prime minister, Ana Brnabic, grew by one this week as her partner, Milica Djurjic, gave birth to a healthy baby boy through artificial insemination. Brnabic's appointment as Serbia's first female and first out prime minister in 2017 by the country's populist president was a surprise. Sexual and gender minorities in the Balkan nation face routine harassment and sometimes violent assaults. There are no anti-discrimination laws, and same-gender couples are not legally recognized. But the couple has attended public events together without incident. They met at a Belgrade gay bar. Djordjevic works as a doctor. Brnabic was scheduled as head of state to visit Brussels this week to lobby for Serbia's admission to the European Union. But she postponed the trip to be with her spouse and new family addition. The PM's office announced that both birth mother and baby, whom the couple has named Igor, are doing fine.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 23rd, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
The race may be over, but her inspiring trail will never be erased. This Way Out's Lucia Chappelle reports.
Author, activist, youth advocate, lesbian feminist rabble-rouser, and long-distance runner, Patricia Nell Warren died of lung cancer at the age of 82 on February 9th in Santa Monica, California. Warren's storied career is known the world over, but the backstory of the woman who brought queer stories into the foreground may not be so familiar. She talked about her early life in a 1994 interview with This Way Out's Josie Cotoggio.
Tell me a little bit first about yourself and your life, because very many people know your work, but they don't really know much about you, and why a woman would write primarily novels about gay men.
Well, I very much grew up among men on a big cattle ranch in Montana. I was a very butch tomboy kid. I grew up in muddy cowboy boots, totally surrounded with men and for the most part. And so really throughout my life, I've had a real big concern for what goes on in their heads, the negative side as well as the positive side, and a very big concern for them as human beings. I think that men in our culture are every bit as messed up as women are and in desperate need of healing. And healing between the sexes. And I look at myself as a writer and a person who is that kind of bridge. I think we need that kind of common understanding.
And when did you first become aware of your own gayness?
Well, I certainly didn't think of it as gayness at the time, but I was 12 going on 13 years old, and she was a town girl, and who was just, I thought, the most beautiful thing that walked the earth. This was a time when Gone with the Wind was around again on reruns in the theaters, and every girl in town was very much into digging their mom's old chiffon dresses out of the trunk in the basement, and we would have slumber parties where everybody sort of dressed up in Civil War drag, and I kind of thought of her as my Scarlet, and I was her Rhett Butler, and I certainly did not think of it as lesbian. I had never heard people talk about homosexuality, never heard the word lesbian, that didn't come until much later. All I knew was how I felt about her.
So what happened as you grew up? What changed?
I did the thing that many, many women do, which is that I really tried to fit into the whole heterosexual conformity of our culture, and I really tried to pour myself into dresses and to get married, and I was married for 13 years. I mean, I really gave it a good try. The marriage was, on the one hand, a very painful and very negative experience, and on the other hand, it taught me a lot of things that I certainly wouldn't know if I hadn't gone through it. And all of this time, I had been a writer and was honing my skills as a writer, starting from when I was in my mid-teens. And the subject was there inside of me as a beingness, and I knew that I wanted to write about it. The question was, how open would I dare to be?
So this was still the 50s, right?
This was still the 50s. And then on into the 60s, during a time when I lived in Spain and I was still married, and finally sat down to write what was, in effect, the first gay novel. My agent showed it to a publisher, William Morrow, in the late 60s. And at that time, Morrow wasn't yet ready. The country just was not ready for this kind of book yet. It was starting to happen. But that same publisher and that editor, Jim Landis, was who we finally went to in 1973 with The Front Runner.
Patricia Nell Warren's 1974 novel, The Front Runner, is about a closeted, conservative ex-Marine coach and his liberating romance with a younger Olympic athlete. It was the first queer-themed book to capture the hearts of a general audience, the first to use the word gay on the cover, the first to make the New York Times bestseller list. Warren said her goal was not just to depict a gay relationship. She also wanted to challenge the myths of masculinity embedded in the sports world. Her myth-busting went beyond that. Warren was one of a dozen women who crashed the Boston Marathon in 1969 to protest discriminatory restrictions on female runners. A longtime editor at Reader's Digest, Warren participated in a mid-70s class action lawsuit to fight the magazine's discrimination against women writers. In 1997, her Wildcat Press joined the ACLU and others suing the Justice Department to stop efforts to censor the internet and strangle online sales of queer content. Warren worked tirelessly to protect the rights of LGBTQ youth, championing legislation and programs for at-risk students. The Front Runner and its two sequels continue to empower both young queers and adults. Patricia Nell Warren was also an early hero for This Way Out. She served on our advisory board, donated autographed copies of her books for our supporters, and wrote endorsement letters to funders. Again, Patricia Nell Warren passed away on February 9th. She is survived by millions of fans around the world who say her books, essays, and actions saved their lives. For This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
Brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother.
This is Essex Hemphill, reminding you that you've tuned into This Way Out.
We will have a national emergency, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court.
I love this song.
Sing along with Trump and Randy Rainbow later in the program.
Everyone thinks that I'm a freak, the way I dress, the way I speak. I'm too thin, I hate my voice. I'd switch lives if I had the choice. I'll be tall and rich someday. Everything will go my way. Someday, someday.
The Outcasting Overtime crew pays tribute to another lost inspirational figure.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Drew, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Alex reflects upon his speech at the gay activist Gilbert Baker's memorial rally in June of 2017.
Many of our guests join us over the phone, but Gilbert wanted to meet us and get to know us, so he came in person. After our interview, we talked with him for a couple of hours. The conversations I had with him were more thought-provoking than any others I've had. Few schools teach gay history. Mine certainly hasn't. Many obituaries credit the creation of the rainbow flag to a challenge from Harvey Milk. Gilbert told me that although it makes for a good story, it isn't true. As Milk gained more prominence, so did Gilbert's rainbow flag designs. He told me that there was a real need to push for change and reform. He thought that if we didn't confront our representatives for denying us our rights, then they would never give them to us.
Gilbert was interviewed by Alex on Outcasting a month before he died. To the best of our knowledge, it was Gilbert's last interview. Both the interview with Gilbert and a recording of Alex's speech can be found on our website, outcastingmedia.org.
One of my first interviews after I joined Outcasting was with Gilbert Baker, the creator of the rainbow flag. His activism spanned decades, from his time working with Harvey Milk through the AIDS crisis, up until a few weeks after our interview, when he died suddenly and unexpectedly. As a young queer person who hadn't explored beyond the straight world, the LGBTQ community felt alien to me. There weren't any gay celebrities who particularly resonated with me except for Ellen DeGeneres, but her cheery and effervescent attitude seemed comically opposite to mine growing up, sullen and antagonistic. And there weren't any gay-themed events or organizations that I could go to except for Outcasting, which I had joined fairly recently. My life felt like a waiting game until I was in college, where I would be able to embrace my identity unlike in high school. But then this speech came up in my life, and I latched onto it as a moment of entry for me into that community, cathartic and life-changing. Finally, a beginning to my own story. Then the day finally came. I drove down to the city, unfortunately after eating a massive bowl of spicy noodles. I made the speech. Then there was applause, and it was over. That was it. My friends who were there and my family congratulated me. I told everyone that I had enjoyed it, despite being a bit nervous. But, on the inside, I felt confused and irresolute, scared by the absence of relief that I thought I would feel. In retrospect, I had no idea what I was expecting. Some welcome party? I beat myself up over the memory of the day. I had imagined that I would want to tell all my friends about it, every detail. I ended up not really mentioning it. My life hadn't changed, and I sunk back into routine. All the while, my view of the speech grew worse and worse. I began to think of it as a failure, in order to explain why my expectations were so wrong. I couldn't figure out why it wasn't a cathartic moment, and why I was only left with emptiness. One day, my brother sent me a link to an article in Teen Vogue, in which a two-sentence blurb about my speech was written, along with a quote from it. I felt conflicted about seeing my name there, still carrying my confused resentment. But, just for a moment, I allowed myself to feel the slightest sliver of satisfaction. I went back and watched a video of the speech, which I hadn't done before, and let myself have another moment, seeing myself up in that stage. And I made myself start to tell my friends who I hadn't told before. Slowly, my opinions began to change. Now I do see it as a pivotal moment of my life, but not for the reasons I thought I would, and not to the same effect. When the day didn't go exactly as I had planned, I jumped to look for what I did wrong. Now, looking back, I can't find anything. So I see that my only mistake was before the day itself, in my inflated expectations. And I expected to learn something about community and how to find one I fit into. I did. A sense of belonging isn't something that will happen overnight, lickety-split. It's something that is completely in my control, but that I have to work on over time, trying to involve myself with people and groups, not big, lofty ideas.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit independent producer based in New York. Our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Madonna plus Randy Rainbow equals another tune to tango with the Trumpster.
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. Will you, in fact, declare a national emergency at the southern border?
I'll sign the final papers as soon as I get into the Oval Office, and we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court.
I love this song.
And hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court. Just like the band, they sued us in the Ninth Circuit, and we lost, and then we lost in the appellate division.
Sweetie.
And then we won.
Some say that you're just concocting this crisis to get the money for your wall. Well, I mean, it was a wall, and then it was a fence. What's it today? Some chicken wire and an ADT security decal?
No.
Couple of Doberman pinchers and a sprinkler? Thank you.
You're fake news.
Some say that you're just fear-mongering and using inflated statistics to help your own agenda.
Not too many people have said that.
Some say that you're full of sh**, and others will agree that you're just fomenting fear and hate with your hyperbole.
Drugs and gangs and people, it's an invasion.
Now push has come to shove. You shut down the gov just to try and get your way.
I didn't need to do this.
Your only interest is campaign promises. Can we believe a word you say?
No.
Girl, you're at an impasse. Now they're gonna sue your ass, but you just keep pushing me.
You don't don't have a border, you don't have a country.
Border lies, freaking us out while you traumatize all the stats you claim you've been shown back in your border lies.
Border lies,
great for distracting from Russian ties, more insulting than your skin tone, talking about border lies.
Sir, you told us that Mexico would reimburse us for the wall. Is it true that you will allow them to pay entirely with 20% off coupons from Bed Bath & Beyond?
Where the hell did that come from?
I have my sources. My mom posted it on Facebook.
Well, he's quick to rush to racist, rash decisions on a whim.
I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I didn't need to do this.
But the only national emergency we have is him.
And by the way, Trump is crazy.
He dupes and he deceives, but still his base believes the MAGA mantras he repeats.
Make America great again.
He said that Mexico would pay for it if so. I'd sure like to see your receipts.
No.
Girl.
Hit that Adderall.
Take a sip.
And go get your border wall. And stop being such a tease.
We're getting it done.
Border lies. Even Ann Coulter is getting wise. You're just walking like a echoing border lies.
Border lies.
Border lies. Let's just hope your face doesn't recognize you're just dangling a carrot
to rest up in border lies.
Sorry. Guess I got a little carried away.
Let's not talk about it.
Okay. It's too bad Mike Pence isn't here. He loves Madonna.
I don't know her.
Borderlies.
Thank you very much.
You can find more of Randy Rainbow's political parodies at randyrainbow.com. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Tanya Kane Perry and Christopher Gall, produced with Brian DeShazer, and from Alicia Chappelle and Outcasters Drew and Alex, produced by Mark Sofist. You heard music from the Chariots of Fire movie soundtrack and by David Brown, Madonna, and Randy Rainbow. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This way out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Paul Bannon, Christopher Matthews, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, Richard Merkin, Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 2HOT, Cobart, New South Wales, KGIGLP, Modesto, California, WMBR, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.